So good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is April 21st. We're going to finish up census, actually special census today. And we are scheduled to have exam number 4 1 week from today. So that's going to cover special census in the heart, and chances are we're going to have it then. Okay, but make sure you come to class on Monday to see if that's true. All right, depends on how it goes. All right, so what's the difference between a general sense and a special sense? What can you tell me about a general sense? You have receptors for that particular modality of energy all over your body, right? Like cold would be a modality of energy, and you have cold receptors all over your body, hot receptors, right? So you have temperature receptors all over your body. Vibration, the sense of vibration you have everywhere all over your body. And here's kind of a weird one, and that is proprioception. What is proprioception? Anybody remember what proprioception is? It's the sense of body position and how much tension is being produced by various muscles, actually all the muscles in your body, and the angulation of joints. So even without looking at your body, you know what position you're in, and all that information is going to your brain to maintain balance, to maintain equilibrium. And since you have those receptors all over your body, that's a general sense, even though it sounds like it's a special one, right? Proprioception sounds special, but it's not, because special refers to what? In terms of receptors, only one or two locations. Yeah, we got a couple receptors that you might find in two locations, but they're usually from a highly complex organ, right? And a good example of a special sense would be taste, only on your tongue. Vision, only from two eyes, right? So those are some important special senses. All right, so let's talk about the first one, which is the sense of olfaction. Of course, you got to know what olfaction means. That is the sense of smell. All right, and that's a good place to start, because that relates to the first what? First nerve. Somebody said nerve, like cranial nerve. What's the name for cranial nerve number one? The olfactory nerve, right? That's the most anterior sense organ on your face, so this is a good place to start. So in order for you to appreciate smells or odors, they're the same thing in air, a odor molecule, or sometimes we call these odorants, have to bind to receptors that are in the cells in your nasal cavity. And when those receptors are bound to an odorant molecule, that initiates an action potential in the olfactory nerves. Now, what the heck is an action potential? Who knows something about an action potential? What's an action potential? What's it due to? Sodium and potassium. Yes, sodium moving in. That's what we call depolarization. Potassium leaving the cell. Right? And then if that cell propagates, that becomes an action potential or a nerve impulse going down a nerve. Okay, so to start that, an odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor. And then, of course, those signals enter the brain via cranial nerve number one, and they're processed by the temporal lobe. So that's where you have the appreciation for various kinds of senses. So here we see a nice sagittal section of somebody's face, okay, facial bones right here, and here is the olfactory nerve, olfactory tract, and here is the olfactory bulb. Probably familiar with this from lab. So let's zoom into this region right here. And you can see that this is the ethmoid bone, and there are holes in the ethmoid bone that we call olfactory foramina. And this has got a special name, this horizontal plate of the ethmoid bone, and that's what? The cribriform plate that has all of these olfactory foramina. Okay. Well, there are special sensory neurons that are bipolar cells. So remember, it's hard to find bipolar cells in your body, but special senses is one place where we find bipolar neurons. And you see the cell body embedded in the olfactory epithelium that is really inside your nasal cavity. And this is kind of a strange thing, because this is the only part in your body where you actually have neurons that are dangling outside of your body. They're just out there in free space, all right? Especially these olfactory cilia, because those odorant molecules have to bind to these processes right here in order for you to perceive the sense of smell. All right, so then the bipolar cells send information. All right, so you got the dendrite of a bipolar cell, and you got the axon of a bipolar cell going through the cribriform plate, where they synapse with the mitral cell, all right, in the olfactory bulb, and then the mitral cell has axons that take information to the temporal lobe. All right, so that's pretty much how all that works. So in the lining of the nasal cavity, you have these epithelial cells, which we call support cells. You have some glands, okay, that secrete the mucus and other compounds into the nose, but you also have this other strange kind of cell right here, this basal cell, okay? Well, what do you think the life of these bipolar cells are like compared to a neuron that's in the brain, that's protected by the meninges, that's surrounded by cerebral spinal fluid, right? That is the concentration of all important metabolites are being regulated all the time, as compared to these bipolar cells that are just kind of hanging out in the environment. Guess what happens to these guys? They get beat up all the time, and they don't have a very long life. And here is something pretty interesting, because what do you know about the regenerative properties of the nervous system? If you damage a nerve, like a spinal cord or part of your brain, can you get it to grow back? No, right? But in the nose, these basal cells do replace these olfactory receptor cells pretty regularly, because they just have a hard job, because they're just sitting out in the environment. To anything that you breathe in through your nose, right, can attack these cells right here. So that's pretty interesting. Something about these basal cells, they act like stem cells that can replace these bipolar neurons. Well, that would be pretty interesting if someday somebody could take some of these basal cells and figure out how to trick them into rebuilding somebody's spinal cord. For instance, if the spinal cord gets damaged, right, because it's a stem cell. All right, so we'll be learning more and more about these all the time. All right, so there are about 7 primary odors, and you probably can imagine what these things smell like. Like there's a flowery sense, an etheric sense, and musky and camphorous, sweaty, rotten, right, and stinging. That's a kind of an acid sense. And so you have receptors to all these different kinds of compounds, and when you try to smell something, then each one of these will contribute a little bit of a sensation to your consciousness, and from how much of each of these participate in the smell you're smelling, right, you'll be able to tell if it's a strawberry, for instance, or an apple, or an orange, right, because it has various components of these primary different kinds of odors. Okay. All right, so these compounds, for instance, like acid, these acid molecules actually have to enter your nose and bind to receptors in order for you to have that sense of smell. Okay, and have you ever been by a oil refinery and you smell kind of a rotten smell? And that's because there are sulfide compounds. Our mercaptan is a sulfur kind of compound that's in the air and actually enters your nose and binds to those receptor cells, right? And that gives you the sense of a rotten smell. All right, so that's the olfactory system. Gustation is the sense of taste, all right? And y'all know, where can you taste things? On your tongue, right, or inside your mouth, right? So there are taste buds, accumulations of receptor, like organs on your tongue. So here is somebody's tongue. And if you stick your tongue out in the mirror and you look, you can see that it has like a little velvety appearance. You can actually see little projections coming off the surface of your tongue that we call papillae. Now, commonly people call papillae taste buds, but you got to know that it's not really a taste bud. Okay, those are just papillae. Those are just projections coming off your tongue. And when you look at the tongue, notice that we can see different kinds of papillae depending on what location of the tongue you're looking at. There's fungiform papillae, more on the tip, right? There's circumvallate papillae, kind of toward the back and base of the tongue, okay? And these have different jobs. Okay, so let's look at a papillae. So here is a papillae. This is a circumvallate papillae. And like I said, that is not a taste bud. Because just like for the sense of smell, there has to be tastant molecules that bind to receptors that are on a particular cell. So if we look just in one small region of a papillae, right, we get this object right here. And this is really what we call a taste bud. So here is one cell, here's another cell, right? These are the support cells, these are the receptor cells that have receptors, and then here is the cranial nerve that brings that sense of taste to your central nervous system. All right, so can you see this structure with your naked eye? No, because it's made out of cells, just a handful of cells, right? So you can't see anything this small. So this thing really is the taste bud. So every papillae might have thousands and thousands of taste buds on them. All right? So the papillae that you see is not really a taste bud. It's just a papillae that's covered, that's loaded with taste buds. And the way that a tastant molecule has access to this taste bud right here is through a taste pore. So a molecule actually has to dissolve in saliva, and then it has to diffuse into the taste bud in order for you to taste it. And that molecule has to bind to these little projections that are coming off the receptor cell that we call gustatory hairs. Not that they're hairs, they're just little projections coming off, almost like a dendrite. Okay. All right, so then when those receptor cells bind to a tastant molecule that causes an action potential on some cranial nerves, and you can see some cranial nerves like the facial nerve and the glossopharyngeal nerve right here carries signals in, and you can see that this is a nice unipolar neuron, carries it into the solitary nucleus in the medulla oblongata, and then there's a second order neuron that takes that to the thalamus, and remember the thalamus is a relay center for sending sensory information to the proper cortex, cerebral part of the cortex. And then a third order neuron takes the information to the gustatory cortex right here in the incus. All right, now there are primary taste sensations as well, we had for the olfactory system. And the primary taste sensations are sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and one that relates to deliciousness or the sense of fulfillment when you eat something, and we call that umami. And each one of these particular senses has its own particular taste bud and own particular receptors. Right? And when you taste something, depending on how much sour is in that food and how much sweet and salty, you can tell me, you know, what kind of food it is. Right, based on these primary taste sensations. So, for instance, what would be a good kind of example? Yeah, that's what you were going to say. You were going to ask me. What's a good example of that?
What I wanted to know was how does salting all your food, your taste buds, doesn't it weaken them?
Does it weaken them? I'm not sure it weakens them, but you have taste buds that respond to salt. And does anybody know what the chemical compound salt really is? Yeah, it's sodium chloride. All right, that's a compound. But when you put salt in water, does it fall down as a rock to the bottom of the glass, or does it dissolve in water? Yeah, a lot of salt can dissolve in water. So actually, NaCl breaks into sodium ion and a chloride anion. So it breaks up, and this sodium in certain kinds of taste buds, right, can enter a cell. So here we have a tastant receptor, and there happens to be just a little channel in this cell that allows sodium to enter, but not any other ions. All right, and what did we call? What did we call that when sodium enters a cell? Yeah, that's called the depolarization phase of an action potential. So just by putting sodium chloride in your mouth, you're adjusting the electrical properties of the cell because sodium could enter this cell, and that will initiate action potentials to the brain. And how many action potentials go depends on how salty your food is. Okay, so that's pretty easy to figure that one out. But other kinds of compounds have a little bit more complicated schemes, but that's just one way of doing it. Okay, all right, so thinking about a food that has maybe all of these different components. How about a margarita? When you taste a margarita, what can you taste? Can you taste sweet? Yeah, can you taste sour? Maybe a little bit of bitter? How about salt? Yeah, okay, that's good.
French fries.
Well, salty, and I don't know if I can break that down, but I'm sure there are people that know all the little particular ins and outs of all various kinds of foods. Okay. All right. And, all right, the gustatory cortex is in the parietal lobe. Okay, vision. Vision is a special sense, of course, because you can't see with your belly button or elbow, anything like that. There are two main kinds of structures, right? Just like when we said the integument has skin and accessory structures, the vision system has primary visual structures and accessory structures as well. And the job of the accessory structures is to protect your vision, the primary structure. So accessory structures would be eyebrows. Maybe I'll just take a look at a picture right here. Okay, so we got eyebrows, and there are sensory nerves on these eyebrows, so if anything brushes up against your forehead, you know that there is an object that is approaching your face, and then that will cause a blink reflex to close your eyes. Same thing for eyelashes, right? Those are special sensory adaptations, so that produces a blink response when something is about ready to gouge your eyeball, right? And the eyelids, right here. What's a real name for an eyelid? That's a palpebra. Palpebra is an eyelid. You got a superior palpebra and an inferior palpebra. And here's the palpebral fissure when you open up your eyelids. All right. And then we have some angles on the palpebral fissure. Here's the lateral angle. All right. Here is the medial angle right here. And there is a membrane that covers the eyeball. We call that the conjunctiva, and it's continuous with the membrane that lines the inside of a palpebrae, right? So that's all conjunctiva. All right, let's take a look at another picture. So here's an illustration. Here is the eyeball. The most anterior part is very clear and transparent. That's what we call the cornea. All right, and then the white part right here is the sclera. That's a layer of the eye, and on top of the sclera, right on the anterior part of the eye, this is the conjunctiva. So this is the bulbar conjunctiva that's on the eyeball, and it's continuous with the palpebral conjunctiva right here. And so it's the job of this conjunctiva to keep foreign bodies out of your eye, but also to lubricate and moisten the surface of the eye. Okay, so there are some glands that moisten the surface of the eye. There's one in the superior palpebra right here that's called a tarsal gland, and that secretes kind of like an oily film. And so oil is like a little water barrier, so it helps maintain the watery nature of the conjunctiva, prevents your eye from drying out. Because remember, water doesn't like to dissolve in oil, so it can't get through right over here. And there's another gland that secretes much more volume, and that is the lacrimal gland. Lacrimal gland is on the superior lateral aspect of the eye. It produces tears, which is really a watery solution, not much oil in tears. All right, so the lacrimal gland secretes its product into these excretory ducts, which then flow over the surface of the eye. Now, what kind of gland is this, the lacrimal gland? Is that an exocrine gland or an endocrine gland? Exocrine gland, because that's a definition, right? If a gland has ducts, that's an exocrine gland. All right, then tears flow into this lacrimal punctum right here and right over here, which is a little foramen, okay? And then tears enter the canaliculus, and there's two canaliculi, and then finally into the nasal lacrimal duct, which then empties into your nasal cavity right here. So that when you're producing tears, that's why you have a runny nose. And, you know, you could probably see little videos on the internet where people fill up their nose with water and actually get it to squirt out this lacrimal punctum right over here, or other things, you know, like milk or something. Looks pretty weird. And I've had students that could actually hold their nose and pressurize their nasal cavity and get their little nasal or lacrimal puncta to squeak a little bit. Okay, so I don't know if any of you have those really special little things that you can do or not, but, right, so your nasal cavity certainly is connected to your palpebrae right here. All right, so these are all accessory structures, right? So they're designed to protect the eye. Okay. All right, there are some extrinsic eye muscles that move the eyeball around, even though you don't move your head. You don't have to change your head position to look in different directions. And all of these muscles are called extrinsic eye muscles. There are six of them that you need to control your eye. There are four rectus muscles. And rectus means what? Just straight, right? So here's a lateral rectus. Here's a superior rectus. Here's inferior. And guess what? Here's a medial rectus over here. So if this is the lateral side, about in this region right here above the eye is going to be the lacrimal gland, right? That big gland right above the eye. And then we got a couple oblique muscles. Here's the inferior oblique, and here is the superior oblique extrinsic eye muscle. And these extrinsic eye muscles, right, are designed so that when light enters the eye, the object that you're looking at falls right on this part of the eye back over here, which is called the macula lutea. The macula lutea gives you your best vision, and so the extrinsic eye muscles are positioning the eyeball so that the image falls right on this region right here. Even though you can see on either side of it, the macula lutea gives you your best vision. All right, so here we have a really good exam figure that shows all the parts of the eye. And let's start with the layers. The eye has three layers. The most superficial layer right here is the sclera, right? And that's white. That's really tough. Contains a lot of collagen, a lot of connective tissue. And you probably discovered that we don't even have any scissors or scalpels in lab that are sharp enough to cut the sclera because it's tough. I mean, you really had to push really, really hard on the sclera to get to these inner structures right here, and hopefully there wasn't a lot of eyeball juice that came squirting out at you. Okay, or maybe you were wearing a mask, which is a really good idea. Okay. All right, so the sclera protects the eye, but also gives the eye its shape. All right, continuous on the anterior pole of the eye, continuous with the sclera, is the cornea. And it's really part of the sclera, but it's adapted to a different function, not to be tough, right, but to be transparent and clear, so it's a relatively delicate kind of tissue, and it's transparent so that light can enter the eye. And the shape of the cornea can be adjusted pretty easily, and that's the point of LASIK procedure, right? Just by changing, getting rid of a few cells on the surface of the cornea, that can dramatically change the shape of the cornea. And notice the cornea has this curvature to it. So it actually acts like a lens, right? So here is the lens, and the lens works like a lens. It focuses light because it has what? Curvature. As a matter of fact, the most powerful lens that the eye has or element that curves light is the cornea. That is the most important thing. We'll talk about the job of the lens in just a little bit. All right, so the cornea is just a continuation of the sclera. The next deepest layer is the choroid. And the choroid contains blood vessels and some connective tissue and other cells that protect the retina. So the job of the choroid is to nourish and protect the retina. So the retina is the third layer, and it contains photoreceptor cells. In this class, you should know that there are basically two kinds of photoreceptor cells. All right, so what part of the retina did I say gives you your best vision? Macula lutea, and in particular, even the very central dot of the macula lutea, which we call the fovea centralis, that's a little depression in the macula lutea, has a kind of cell that allows you to see in color, and it allows you to see in fine detail, very small objects. That's your best vision, and those cells are called cone cells. So the fovea centralis has 100% cone cells. The macula lutea almost has 100%, but not quite. Okay, there are other cells that we find in there that are called rod cells. And as you move out more to your peripheral vision, the cone cells disappear, and the kinds of receptor cells that populate the retina then are rod cells. So rod cells don't give you quite as good a vision because they're not receptive to color. You can only see shades of gray and black and white. The other thing is, for rods, is because they're bigger cells, you can't see very fine detail with them either. You can get some general impressions of objects. You can tell shades of gray, but that's about it. So you might ask, well, gee whiz, why do we have any rod cells at all? Why don't we just have cone cells? If they're so much better, why don't we just have cone cells? Because, as with many, many things, there are always trade-offs, right? Maybe you want a vehicle that's really speedy, that gets good gas mileage, you can whip in and out of traffic with, right, to get to school in a hurry. So what would you choose to do that? That's very economical, fast, and you can highly maneuverable. What kind of vehicle could do that? Motorcycle, somebody said. Perfect example, right? Okay? So you get good gas mileage, but what's the trade-off to having a motorcycle? Accidents. You can't put a big fancy stereo with subwoofers on it. At least I haven't seen it, but that would be, I guess, pretty cool. All right, so what do you need? Well, you need a bigger car. If you want all those amenities, you need a bigger car. But what's the trade-off to having a bigger car? More, maybe not more insurance, but what? More gasoline, it's more expensive, you can't whip around through traffic, right? And then if you need to haul a lot of stuff, like cross-country, like if you're moving, then a car won't even do the job. You need a truck, right? So there's always trade-offs. So the trade-off with these receptor cells, what are the two receptor cells before I digressed into automotive? They are the rods and cones, right? So the cones are in the macula lutea, the rods are in the periphery, all right? The trade-off is that these really good cone cells need bright light in order to work, right? Sunlight is the best for them, okay? So that's the trade-off. And if you don't have bright light, they don't work, so you have rod cells that can work under dim light conditions, but the trade-off there is that you can't see fine detail and you can't appreciate color. So that's the trade-off between those two. Okay. And those cells are located in the retina according to that distribution that we just talked about. All right. Well, there are two important cavities, two important chambers in the eye, and the line that separates them is the lens right here. So everything behind the lens is a chamber that we call the posterior segment. All right, so follow the discussion here for a little bit, and you'll see why we call it a segment and not a cavity. All right, and in this posterior segment right here, it's filled with a fluid that's very viscous. It's like jelly or jello, and so we call that vitreous humor. The vitreous humor presses up on the retina, and it holds it up against the choroid because in the retina there shouldn't be any blood vessels. Right, or very, very few, because if there are blood vessels, guess what? That pushes photoreceptor cells out of the way. And if you don't have photoreceptor cells in the retina, what is your vision like?
Blurry.
Well, either blurry or you're blind. Okay, so there should not be many blood vessels in the retina because it pushes away your photoreceptor cells. So the job of this vitreous humor is to press the retina up against the choroid so that it can get nutrients and oxygen and get rid of waste products and things like that. Okay, so a lot of times the retina can separate from the choroid under conditions of head trauma, like you get into an accident or something in your vehicle, and after the retina has pulled away from the choroid, guess what happens to that part of the retina? It's not nourished and it necroses, it dies, and then you have, right, a blind spot in your vision. That's terrible when that happens. Okay. Or even people that are, you know, boxers that like to go into the boxing ring and get their head punched. Okay, that can happen. And actually that happened to a really famous, a really good boxer one time. And his doctor said you shouldn't go into the ring because it might exacerbate that condition and you might lose complete vision in that eye. Does anybody know who that was? And it was kind of kept a secret for a long time because if another boxer knew you had a blind spot in one part of your vision, then they would always come at you from that direction. And that was Sugar Ray Leonard. Anybody hear of Sugar Ray Leonard? Maybe a couple of you people. But he was such a good boxer that nobody hardly ever hit him in the head. no one hit him in the head again to hurt his vision, so he was pretty lucky. So that was just a decision he made. I don't know how many millions of dollars he earned from going back in the ring, but that was kind of an iffy trade-off, right? Millions of dollars versus losing your vision. That would be a really kind of tough decision to make. Okay. All right, so that's vitreous humor in what chamber of the eye? Posterior segment. All right, so now let's go to the lens, and let's go anterior to the lens. That's got a different kind of fluid. That's called aqueous humor, a watery fluid, right? And you know, water can flow very easily from one part of the body to another based on pressure. And if we look at this segment of the eye that's anterior to the lens, notice it has two compartments. There's one compartment that is touching the lens right here, which is what? Posterior compared to this part right here. So this anterior segment of the eye has an anterior cavity and a posterior cavity, and it contains aqueous humor in both of those. So that's why we have to call these segments, because this anterior segment is complicated. It's got a couple cavities associated with it. Okay. And let's see. Here is the lens. So what's the job of the lens? But in order to, I think, appreciate what the lens is doing for us, let's continue looking at the structure, because the structure of this part of the eye is going to determine its... Guess what structure determines?
Eye color.
It determines eye color, but not the lens per se. There's something else in the lens that determines eye color, namely the iris right here. That determines your eye color. Okay, but the structure determines the function of a particular structure inside your body. Okay, so let's look some more at the structure. Here is a muscle that we call the ciliary body or ciliary muscle, and it has ligaments coming off of it that we call suspensory ligaments. Sometimes we might call that the ciliary zonule, and it wraps all the way around the lens. Right? And that muscle can put tension on the lens or release tension, and if you pull on something from side to side, it's going to get longer, but what else is going to happen maybe as it gets longer? Can you picture what might happen? It gets thinner as a result. And when you release the tension, it gets shorter, but it gets thicker then. So the lens is changing shape all the time. It's getting thin, getting thick, right? And you might ask, all right, so that's due to what? The ciliary muscle and these suspensory ligaments right here. But the good question would be, why does the lens have to change shape all the time? When it changes shape, it changes the focusing power so that light is always going to focus right at this level on the lens. And depending on how far away an object is from your body, the amount of focusing that's necessary is different. So the way that you see something clearly up close is a lot different than how you see something clearly if it's far away from you. So we could do a really quick experiment. Like take your index finger and put it in front of your nose, pretty far away, stretch it out. Now focus on your fingernail. Is it in focus? Okay, now what can you tell me about the background? Don't concentrate on the background, but you can see everything back there. Is your background in focus?
No.
All right, so you can only focus on one distance from your face at a time. Right, you can't focus on everything. All right, so keep your finger out there. Now look in the back of the room. Focus on all those people that you couldn't see before. Now what happened to your fingertip?
Blurry.
It's blurry, or you see two of them. Okay, so that process of focusing at a particular distance away from your eyes is what we call accommodation. So the job of the lens is accommodation. It allows you to focus on something close up, but not far away, or something far away, but what? Not close up. You can't do both at the same time, and that's just the laws of physics. You can't do anything about that, and cameras do exactly that same thing, okay? And you'll see that if you watch movies or TV shows, that without changing the scene, right, the camera all of a sudden will focus on somebody over here and then close up, and they use that technique to tell a story. All right, so that's the job of the lens. And of course, the lens has to be perfectly transparent so that light can pass through it. And the lens can be damaged by sunlight and it turns opaque. Guess what we call that when the lens turns opaque? That means it starts to block light. We call that cataracts. Cataracts. Okay, cataracts. And so then it's like looking through a fog all day long. And then this lens has to be pulled out. Okay. And then I don't know what you do. I don't know what the modern treatment is. Maybe surgery. You need to pull that out. And then maybe you can have another lens put in, like a prosthetic lens, for instance. I'm not up on the latest technology, but probably it's not as cool as the one you really had because it probably can't change shape, right? But it does help you adjust for one vision or the other, and then you need glasses to do some corrections. All right, the other structure that we see just anterior to the lens is the iris, and it's circular, and it has muscles in it, and it can constrict and it can dilate. Right, so the job of the iris is to adjust for the amount of ambient light. So if it's really bright where you're looking, the iris constricts, that reduces the amount of light entering the eye, and that protects the retina right here. If it's very dim, the iris dilates, and that lets more light in for you to see. Now this hole in the iris is not really a structure, it's really just a foramen in the iris, and we call that the pupil, right? Which is usually very, very, very dark on people. Okay, because once light enters the eye, at least in humans, light doesn't bounce back out. It's absorbed by pigments that are in the choroid right here. So that's another job of the choroid, to absorb light so that it doesn't bounce around. If it bounced around inside your eye, then you'd see flashes and things like that. Now, you might know that if you're ever to take a picture of maybe a cat or a dog that you have at home and you use a flash, what can you tell? Or if you're out at night and you have a flashlight, or if the light is just right and you look into your dog's eyes, what do you see? Right. Yeah, you see a bright pupil right here because they have special reflective pigments in their choroid, right? So that when light enters, it reflects back out the way it came, and that actually helps them see under really dim light conditions. And it comes right out their pupil right here, so it doesn't look like they have a black pupil. It's kind of like shiny or iridescent, or it actually has maybe kind of a red color to it because of all the blood that's in the choroid right here. All right, so can you see that? Oh, sorry about that analogy. Can you see that the lens, right, and the iris, in order for your vision to be normal, have to be doing what? Not just sitting there, but doing what? Moving around all the time. Yeah, getting thinner, thicker, contracting, dilating all the time. So this is a very active part of your eye right here. Okay. Well, let's just say one last thing about this aqueous humor, which is kind of dangerous. Okay. And that is, the cornea is relatively delicate, and it can be damaged by foreign bodies hitting the cornea, and it can rip a hole in the cornea. I know you guys are making some faces. That's good. You don't ever want that to happen. Because if there's a hole in the cornea, guess what happens to that aqueous humor as opposed to this vitreous humor? It's just going to dribble right out of the eye, right out of that anterior segment. No problem. Gravity will just drain it out. And now there is nothing separating the cornea from the iris. And there's no fluid separating the iris from the lens right here. And as a matter of fact, then there's nothing separating the cornea from the lens. And these structures touch each other. And no one has ever figured out a way, once these structures touch each other, how to unseparate them. So these structures are now glued together for the rest of your life, right? That the aqueous humor will come back, all right, but now it won't be able to flow like it should and separate these different structures. So you can imagine, what is your vision like if the iris is touching the lens? Okay, well, what are these things supposed to do all day long? They're supposed to move around, but if they're glued together, they can't move around properly anymore. So you can't accommodate, you can't adjust for light conditions. And then also, if the cornea is touching the lens, it doesn't have the right shape anymore, right? So your vision is blurry. So it's totally messed up. That's really unfortunate. All right, so what do I like to wear? Glasses to protect my cornea. Okay, so you all should be really careful, especially in labs, like chemistry labs, physics labs, even anatomy labs. Protect the cornea right here so you don't lose your good vision. But the other thing is, the cornea has a plethora of nerve endings, and when your cornea is damaged, I'm told that that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. Okay? So, and that's really not a good thing, right? So that's another good reason to wear glasses to protect your eyes all the time. All right, especially guys, right? Because guys are doing things, motorcycles, cars, working on things with tools, and tools break and fracture slivers up into your face. So that would be terrible if something were to happen to this cornea right here. Okay. So in order to focus sharply on the retina way back over here, you need the proper curvature of the cornea as well as the proper curvature of the lens. Both of these work together to focus light on the retina. And I think I have that in the slides, because what do we have? We've got an asterisk here on the lens and an asterisk on the cornea. Those two things have to work together to see objects very sharply. Okay. The lens by itself, if you're just thinking about the lens changing shape, what's the process that the lens is going through there to help you see things clearly? What do we call that? That is accommodation. Yeah, shifting your focus based on the distance from your eye. All right, so you got the three layers. You got the sclera, you got the choroid, you got the retina. There are different ways that we can break the different layers of the eye down based on some tunics, the tunics or coverings or coats of the eye. The fibrous tunic is made up of the sclera, cornea, and the scleral venous sinus. Right? And that scleral venous sinus allows for draining of that fluid that's in your eye. All right? So the aqueous humor is produced by these ciliary processes, goes through this posterior chamber of the eye, over the posterior part of the iris, then through the pupil into this anterior chamber, and then into the scleral venous sinus, so that you don't get a buildup of pressure in this anterior segment of the eye. Now, in some people, the scleral venous sinus gets plugged up, or the ciliary process produces too much aqueous humor, and that produces a fairly common disease process that can cause blindness, and that's called glaucoma. All right, so every time you get your eyes checked, they always do a check for glaucoma, because if pressure builds up in this anterior segment, it pushes on the lens, it pushes the lens posterior, so then the lens pushes on the vitreous humor, and then the vitreous humor presses on the retina, and then the retina presses on all those blood vessels. And when you press on a blood vessel, guess what happens to blood flow? It decreases or stops, and then the retina doesn't get oxygen and nutrients, and then the retina slowly dies a little bit every day. So it's hard to notice. So it's very difficult for you to make that diagnosis on your own. You really need an ophthalmologist or an optician or somebody that can make a measurement of the pressure right here. And a really common way of doing that is to just blow a little puff of air on the cornea, and if it wiggles back and forth, then the pressure isn't too high. But if you put a little puff of air on the cornea and it just stays right where it is, doesn't move, then you know that the pressure is way too high. Or sometimes they use an instrument where they actually press on the cornea, right, depending on what instruments are available. I think usually they have to anesthetize the cornea when they use that physical instrument to measure the pressure. But either one of those methods works pretty well. All right, so that vascular tunic then, contains the choroid with blood vessels, the ciliary body, and the iris. And then the sensory tunic is made up basically of the retina, right? Which contains those different kinds of rods and cone cells. Okay. And there are bipolar cells involved with the vision pathway as well. All right, and then the rods and cones cause action potentials to go in through the optic nerve, and then it crosses over at the optic chiasma, and then it becomes the optic tract as it's entering the brain. There's a synapse in the geniculate nucleus of the thalamus. Remember, that's the relay station. And where does the thalamus send visual signals then? To what lobe of the brain?
Parietal.
Yes, but the lobe is the occipital lobe. Occipital lobe. Don't I have that here? Oh, I just have visual cortex. Yeah, visual cortex is the occipital lobe. Sure, it's not going to be frontal lobe because that's motor. It's going to be something behind that, and it is the occipital lobe. All right, so that's some things about vision. So let's move on to hearing. And, okay, here's hearing. So the ear can be broken down into three main regions. There's an external, a middle, and an internal ear. And it has three main regions. It has three main sensations, not characterized by the regions of the ear, but that's maybe one way to remember the three sensations. And the three sensations are hearing, of course, and then two senses for equilibrium, for maintaining balance. And we call that either static equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium. So let's go over the anatomy first and then talk about the senses a little bit. All right, so here we have part of the external ear. This is the auricle. Remember, auricle just means kind of like a flap of skin. The atria have auricles on them as well. All right, sometimes we call that the pinna as well. So here is the helix. All of these little bends have names, but we don't have to know the names. You could just call this the earlobe right down over here. But this acts kind of like a funnel to funnel sound energy into this hole that you have in your head, which is called the external auditory or acoustic meatus. So auditory and acoustic you can use interchangeably. And when that sound energy hits this little barrier right here, it vibrates it back and forth. So this first barrier is what we call the tympanic membrane, and that's what defines the boundary of the outer ear or external ear. So external ear is from the tympanic membrane all the way to the outside world. All right, the next part is the middle ear. It starts at the tympanic membrane, and it contains all of this space. It contains some auditory ossicles, some little tiny bones. And guess what? I have all three bones right between my fingertips right here. All right? Yeah, you got the malleus, incus, and stapes. And nobody could say that I was fooling you because those bones are what? Too small. They could actually all fit between my fingertips right here. All right? So here you see the bones. In the middle ear, there are some muscles, little muscles in the inner ear. When the sound levels get really high and these bones start to vibrate very wildly, those muscles contract and it helps protect your ear from excessive sound pressure levels. All right. Then and that also includes, the middle ear also includes the auditory tube or the pharyngotympanic tube. And it's got another name. It's called Eustachian tube. And everybody has their own particular one that they like to use that's easier to memorize. I know a lot of people that just like to use Eustachian tube. Well, here's a tube that connects the middle ear with your pharynx, which is your throat. I'm going to ask you that sooner or later, what the pharynx is. That's your throat. Okay? Because in order for you to hear things, this tympanic membrane has to vibrate back and forth. And if the pressure inside the middle ear goes really, really high, it pushes the tympanic membrane all the way out and it gets stuck. It can't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, you can't hear anything. Okay? So, for instance, when might that happen? When might pressure here build up? For instance, if you're going to take a trip in an airplane. No? That's not what happens. Yeah, you're taking a trip in an airplane. Okay? And you take off in the airplane and you start to land, the pressure in the airplane is really, really, no, that's the wrong way. It's going to have to be on takeoff. Okay, on takeoff. So the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane, for instance, if you're leaving LAX, is the pressure at sea level, which is pretty high. Right? The plane takes off, it goes higher and higher and higher, up to 10,000, 20,000 feet. The pressure decreases. All right. So what happens is this middle part of the ear, if the Eustachian tube is plugged up, is at sea level pressure, which is high, but this external auditory meatus is at the pressure of the cabin of the airplane, which is really, really low, and that pushes the tympanic membrane all the way out like that. And guess what happens to your hearing? it diminishes or you can't hear anything. The other thing is that can produce a lot of pain as well, and the tympanic membrane can actually rupture. So what can you do to equalize the pressure? You can chew gum, or you can yawn, or sneeze, or pressurize your nose. We call that doing a Valsalva maneuver. And if you do that right now, you might even hear some squeaking. Yeah, I heard some squeaking. I can even hear better right now, okay, after doing that. So I just forced a little air up this little tube right here. So that's part of the middle ear as well. All right. And then we got the inner ear, which contains all of this apparatus for the two equilibrium senses as well as hearing. All right. And the inner ear begins at a little window in the vestibule that has a shape of the footprint of the stapes right here. And it's kind of, the stapes has a footprint of being oval. So guess what we call that window right there? That's the oval window. So sound enters this thing that looks like a snail. That's what we call the cochlea. And if sound gets trapped in there, that might actually fracture the cochlea because it's partly made out of bone. So sound goes in, but there is a little pressure release valve right here, which is called the round window. So sound goes in, rambles around in here a little bit, and then it comes back out into the middle ear so that the cochlea is not damaged. All right, who's got a question on these three parts of the ear? You got external, you got the middle, and internal ear. It has all these different structures. And then here's a nerve that's going to take the sound information in terms of action potentials to the brain. So there is another hole right here. Oh, what bone is this? Anybody remember what bone this is? That's the temporal bone, right? That's right where your ear is. And this, what is this outer hole in the temporal bone called? See, here's the temporal bone here and here. That's the external acoustic meatus. And then this hole that the auditory nerve is going through is the internal acoustic meatus. And you noticed in lab that they match up really well, but it's not, you can't go from one to the other, right? Because then there'd be like a hole from the outside world right into your brain. That wouldn't happen. Yeah. So the tympanic membrane is the eardrum. Yep. It's the eardrum, and it's connective tissue. It's very thin and delicate, and there is a special sweat gland in this external acoustic meatus that secretes a little oil and waxy material to keep it from drying out so that it stays vibrating. Anybody remember what that's called? That's the ceruminous sweat gland in the external acoustic meatus, right? So this part of the temporal bone, you might remember, is called the petrous region. It contains all of this apparatus for hearing and equilibrium. Okay. So what do we got on this slide right here? All right, you got the external acoustic meatus, the tympanic membrane. You can see the three auditory ossicles. Remember, every time you hear ossicle or osseo, you should think bone, right? The one that's connected to the tympanic membrane is the malleus. It kind of looks like a mallet or a hammer. The one in the middle is called the incus because it reminded somebody of a big piece of iron that you would pound on to shape something, right, or an anvil. And then, of course, this one is pretty easy to recognize because it looks like a stirrup that you use for riding horses or something, right? So we call that the stapes. So you got the malleus, incus, and stapes right here. And the footprint of the stapes is oval. So the oval window is right underneath it. So the job of the tympanic membrane, notice the tympanic membrane has a pretty large diameter, but the diameter of the oval window is pretty small. So when the tympanic membrane vibrates a little bit, the oval membrane vibrates a lot, moves back and forth, because it's difficult for sound energy to go from air into fluid, and the inside of all of this apparatus right here is fluid. Maybe you realize that. Have you ever been in a swimming pool, and maybe you're talking to somebody, right, and your head has to be above water, because as soon as it goes below water, what happens? Well, maybe you can hear, maybe you can't, right? The sound gets all distorted, and you can hardly hear. So it's difficult for sound energy to enter, so the ear has evolved to amplify the sound so that it can enter the fluid environment of the ear. And that's the job of all of these bones here as well, is to help sound enter the fluid part of the ear. Okay, here's that nice eustachian tube. You can see some ligaments. Okay. All right, just different views of the ear. All right, so what are we going to talk about first in the ear? Let me go back to this slide right here. All right, some of the bony parts of the inner ear, this thing that looks like a snail, that's the cochlea. That's a bony labyrinth that the organs for hearing are in. Here is the vestibule, and it contains organs for equilibrium. And then we have semicircular canals, which also contain organs for equilibrium. So I think we're going to talk about the vestibule first. The sense for the vestibule is what we call static equilibrium. And static equilibrium gives you the sense of which way your head is oriented with respect to gravity. So it can tell if your head is looking face down or if you're lying down on the back of your head. And it helps maintain equilibrium inside your body because gravity is going to pull on certain things inside the vestibule. All right, so what are these things inside the vestibule? Okay, we can see some nerves. Here are the two structures that can sense which way gravity is pulling. We call these maculae. All right, the maculae are the sense organs. And there are two of them. One is called the utricle, the other is called the saccule. All right, let's see how these work. All right, so inside the maculae of the saccule, all right, and the utricle, right, this is the maculae right here. We see some epithelial cells, kind of that reminds us maybe of the nose, right? Or maybe even on the tongue, taste buds. Here are the receptor cells. These receptor cells have these projections that are sticking off the apical surface. These projections are what we call either stereocilia or kinocilia. And these things can bend depending on which way gravity is pulling. Okay. And another term that we can use for stereocilia or kinocilium is hair. These are like, this is reminded somebody of little hairs sticking out of these cells. So the name for these receptor cells are called hair cells. Okay. The kinocilium and stereocilium project up above the epithelial surface into this little gelatinous mass. So there's like a little stuff that's almost like vitreous humor, but it's actually even tougher than vitreous humor. And embedded in the gelatinous mass are these crystals. So you actually have crystals inside your ear that we call otoliths. All right, anytime you hear this term oto, you should think of hearing or your ear, right? Hearing or ear. This particular organ is not responsible for hearing, but it's a part of your ear. So these little crystals, and they're made out of calcium carbonate, and they act as weights. So gravity is going to pull on the otoliths, and when it pulls on the otoliths, it's going to change the shape of this gelatinous material that the stereocilia are embedded in. So when the stereocilia point straight up, gravity is pulling straight down, and you know what? It's not going to bend the stereocilia one way or the other, but look what happens if you tilt your head forward. Then gravity is going to pull on the otoliths, and it's going to cause this gelatin material to sag in the direction that gravity is pulling. And when it does, look what happens to these hair cells, or the stereocilia on the hair cells. They start to bend. And when they bend, they create action potentials, which then send nerve impulses to the brain, which your brain and cerebellum figure out as being motion in your head. Okay? So we call that static equilibrium because you don't have to move, right? You could just be lying down in the bed or standing with your head erect, and the stereocilia are going to tell your brain what position your head is in. So we call that static equilibrium. Motion is not necessary because gravity is always going to work, right? So here you can see the gelatinous membrane with the otoliths on it, right? That's for static equilibrium. The other kind of equilibrium sense, and static equilibrium is from the vestibule. Remember, you got the maculae in the saccule and utricle right here. The other part of equilibrium is for kinetic equilibrium. And kinetic equilibrium means that you have to be in motion in order for these sense organs to operate. The sense organs are in this little bulge of the semicircular canals. Right, this little bulge, anybody remember from lab what these little bulges are at the base of a semicircular canal? That's called an ampule, right? It's reminded somebody of a little vial that you hold fluid in. Okay, and this little vial, or the ampulla, contains the crista ampullaris, which is the organ for sensing what we call angular acceleration or rotation. So when you start to, another name for that is spinning. When your body starts to spin, this is the organ that is telling your cerebellum that you're starting to spin. And since you have three of them, guess what? It can tell your brain that you're spinning in pretty much any direction, right? Because there's three planes that determine space. You got right, left, up, down, anterior, posterior. And so it can tell you what direction you're spinning in, which is a really good thing. As a matter of fact, you all probably used to do that when you were little kids, because it changes your, right? It gives you like an alternate sense of reality if you were to spin and then stop, right? It kind of messes up your equilibrium. So let's see how that happens. All right, so there's fluid in the semicircular canals, just like in the vestibule over here. We call this endolymph. And what does fluid like to do? It can flow, right? It can move. It can flow from one part of the body to another, but it's trapped in the semicircular canal, so it can flow in a circle, either one way or the other way. Okay. So here is the crista. It's got a cupula, which is a gelatinous mass, which means that it can deform, right? It can bend one way or the other depending on which way endolymph is flowing. If it's flowing in this direction, then it's going to bend this way. If the endolymph is flowing in this direction, the cupula is going to bend in this direction. And just like for the maculae, there are hair cells that have kinocilium and stereocilia project into the gelatinous mass, and when the cupula bends one way or the other, it bends the stereocilia, which then produces action potentials which go through the vestibular nerve to your brain to tell you that you're spinning in one direction or another. All right, so what do you see? What cells do you see that are similar between the maculae for static equilibrium and the crista ampullaris, which is for angular acceleration? You've got these. You've got hair cells. Hair cells. So that's pretty strange, right? So here you have the same kind of cell that's giving you two much different kinds of senses. One is just position of the head, and the other is a spinning motion. It's the same kind of receptor cell. Okay. So I think next time I'm going to have to tell you how that works. All right, so I'm going to tell you how this crista ampullaris works to give you the sense of spinning in either one direction or the other. So you might want to look up the term momentum or inertia before Monday. Yeah.
What's the job of
the endolymph right here? Yes, it's going to start moving. It's going to start flowing over the cupula. And when it does, it's going to bend the stereocilia on these hair cells. And I'm going to tell you next time. You know what determines the spinning. Yeah, it's going to determine the spinning. Yeah, and you're going to see how that is next time.